Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is your new Comics Wednesday episode for October 21st, 2020. I'm flying solo today. I'm going to try to cover what I think is a record number of books. There are a ton of great books. I've read a lot of books already, and there are even more I could have read. Some of the things I wasn't quite caught up on, like Black Magic, other things like Gideon Falls, I'm kind of saving for the finale with the next issue, but yeah, tons of really, really great stuff. So I'm going to try to cover 15 books, and hopefully this doesn't take too long because it's already past midnight and I've got to, you know, record it and then, you know, put it through the cleanup for sound and then build the webpage and get it up so you all can listen to it on the way to your comic shop or what have you to know what to look out for. And yeah, there's just a ton of great books today. So I'm going to start with a title from Aftershock. I covered the first issue. I was very impressed by it. And I wanted to talk about issue two because it's even better. And it's the perfect example of what crime noir and non-superhero comics can be. So it's Miles to Go from the creative team of writer B. Clay Moore. We have art by Stephen Molnar and letters by Thomas Maurer. So if you remember the first time I talked about it, it's about a girl who at a very, very young age became an assassin. And now, you know, that's all in the past. She's recently divorced or at least separated from her husband. She has a young daughter that she's trying to raise. And all of a sudden, for reasons unknown at this point, her past kind of comes back to haunt her, kind of catches up with her. So we saw in the first issue that something terrible befell her mentor, the person who kind of taught her and took her under his wing. And we find out in this issue that he had contingency plans, let's say, if things went sideways. So that's kind of the whole gist of the second issue here with Aaliyah and Amari, Aaliyah being the daughter. And they're just trying to keep their head above water at this point. And so, you know, as I said, when you're talking about what comics can be, this is, as I said, a really good example. And, you know, so often when you talk about comics, people just think, okay, well, superhero stuff. This is, it's so much more than that. And what's great is that B. Clay sets it up where you immediately kind of identify with some of the things that the characters are going through. Like I'm not an assassin, but I can certainly, you know, relate to trying to raise a daughter, you know, like Amara is. And, you know, when you talk about building drama and building story, it's putting, you know, quote unquote, ordinary people in extraordinary situations. And that's how you build drama. And that's what B. Clay is doing here. And he's not taking it, you know, far out on the limb. This isn't superheroes. This isn't fantastical. This is grounded, gritty, crime noir at its best. And I'm so impressed with kind of the tone and the feel that he gives the story and the characters. And Stephen Molnar, the artist, he's the perfect choice. His color work, the colors tend to be, you know, muted. They're not bright, they're not primary like you would expect in a, you know, in a superhero comic. They're much more muted, they're much more tame, and I don't want to say dreary, but they give you that sense of drama, you know, that tone that this isn't the best situation that Amara is in with her daughter. And what's interesting is you can kind of contrast that when we see, and we saw this in the first issue, where we see flashbacks. We see Amara has flashbacks to when she was a kid, and we get even more of them here, where we kind of see how she sort of fell into this life. And when you look at the color work between then and now, you see how much brighter the color is when she's a kid, right? And you think, well, yeah, that makes sense. When she was a kid, there was a little more innocence, at least at first, you know, before she learned to become an assassin, obviously. But there's that hope for the future. And so everything is brighter, as opposed to now when everything is a little darker, the colors are a little more muted, because now she's experienced life, right? And then we get some other flashbacks with one of the other characters where things are kind of sepia toned, again, to give it that mood and that feeling of something happening in the past. And there's one particular panel, I've never seen anybody do this, at least not that I can remember, where Stephen Molnar, he takes the character in the flashback and within one panel, he kind of merges, like the left half of his face is the younger version. And then the right half of the face is the older version as the story, the narrative transitions from the flashback in the past to the present. So I think it's really excellent. It's a perfect example of the kind of quality books that Aftershock puts out. I think too many of them fly under the radar. This is a really, really great crime story, suspenseful, you know, assassins and guns and action and blood and, you know, not for the faint of heart, definitely for mature readers. And it's just got me hooked. Like I read the first issue because I'm, you know, I know B. Clay's work and I trust Mike Martz and the guys over there at Aftershock implicitly. So when I saw B. Clay was doing a project over there, I was like, I definitely have to check this out. I was super impressed with the first issue. And as good as that first issue was, this like leveled up completely. Like it's one of those titles where as soon as I put the issue down, I'm like, man, I can't wait to see what happens next. I can't wait for the next story. Everybody's hitting on all cylinders here, from the writing, the dialogue, the pacing of the story, the line work, the compositions and the transitions from Stephen Molnar, and then the lettering does a great job of, you know, grounding the story and, you know, giving you what you need to know. It's solid. It doesn't pull you out of the story ever. And yeah, just, I can't recommend this book enough. It is just, it's spectacular. So Miles to Go, definitely give it a try. You can probably still find the first issue. I didn't hear about it selling out or anything like that. So pick up the first issue, pick up the second issue when you're at your comic shop today. It is definitely worth your time. All right, on to the next book I'm going to talk about. It's Daredevil. No, it's not Daredevil. Just kidding, sorry. It's Batman White Knight, Harley Quinn. So this is written by the team, husband-wife team, actually, of Sean Murphy and Katana Collins. We've got Katana Collins handling the script, Mateo Scalera on art, Dave Stewart on colors, and Ann World Designs on the lettering. So this is in, obviously, the Batman White Knight verse, if you will, that Sean Murphy created, where the Joker was quote-unquote cured and Batman ended up being sort of the bad guy and went to jail. And so it's from Black Label. The Batman White Knight, the original series, started before Black Label, but then it got kind of retro shifted over there. It's all printed under Black Label now. The second one was under Black Label with Azrael and such. And now this is Katana Collins getting a chance to play in the same universe with this version of Harley Quinn. So we all kind of know how I feel about Harley Quinn. I'm sort of Harley'd out at this point. Her zaniness and her wackiness doesn't really do much for me. But here's the cool thing about Harley. And we see this with, I'm trying to blank on her name. Garcia, I can't remember her first name. Cammy Garcia on her Joker Harley Criminal Sanity. Where when you take away that part of Harley, kind of the crazy screwball sort of Joker influence, and just get down to her roots as a psychologist or a psychiatrist, a criminal profiler, you know, if you want to throw in the background of being a gymnast, you know, she was a gymnast in college in a lot of her background, depending on what version of Harley you're talking about, which multiversal version of Harley, but to the point where she's Olympic level, like, you know, she was an alternate for the Olympic team before she got hurt. And so just take those parts and don't necessarily bring in the, you know, literally the insanity of her getting mixed up with the Joker and, you know, the zany hijinks and the super nasally voice and hitting things over the head with the hammer and all that kind of crazy stuff. The humor part just doesn't work for me that well, but I think she's such a great character because you can leave that part out, the zaniness or the wackiness. And I know some people love that. It's what people love about the Harley Quinn cartoon, that was previously on DC Universe, now on HBO Max. It's what people loved about the Jimmy and Amanda Connor run. And don't get me wrong, I can appreciate that. And I laugh at it as well. I haven't seen the cartoons, but I've seen some of the Dear Harley that's based on the cartoons, where Harley's supposedly answering mail, you know, kind of like a Dear Abby sort of thing. And they can be funny. But I can only take a little bit of that, because it's just not my thing. But what's great about what Katana Collins and Sean Murphy are doing here in Batman White Knight Presents Harley Quinn is they're doing just like Cammy Garcia did in Joker Criminal Sanity. Here's a version of Harley that's much more grounded, that's much more real. You know, she has a couple kids, she has responsibilities, and in typical Harley fashion, she's not handling those that well. But again, just like with Miles to Go that I was just talking about, we see the realism of it, right? She's still Harley Quinn and she still has these responsibilities, but she's not, you know, soccer mom Harley. You know, she's not handling that well. There's a touchstone there. There's things you can relate to. She's crazy in a different way, like a, oh my God, I'm overwhelmed as a parent with these two little kids. So it's kind of an insanity where I want to pull my hair out because I'm so frustrated and that sort of thing. And in the story, she's approached by a member of the extended Bat family who wants her help, not her help as, you know, Harley Quinn, crazy woman with a hammer, but in her professional capacity, right? Like before you were mixed up with Joker, Jack Napier, whatever you want to call him in this version of the DCU, you were a brilliant psychiatrist. You were a brilliant profiler, you know, criminal profiler. And so then that, you know, that's the help that we need. That's what we want from you. And so it's giving Harley some agency, which, you know, that was always the big thing, the big knock against Harley when she was with the Joker. She was just kind of like a walking woman in the refrigerator, right? Just a punchline for his jokes and staying in that abusive relationship and kind of being a poor role model, if you will. Not that I, you know, think she was supposed to be a role model, but, you know, people would look at her and say, well, why, you know, why would she get out of there? Why would she get out of that situation? So here, Katana Collins and Sean Murphy are putting her in a situation where she's not in the best place mentally or emotionally. She's feeling overwhelmed, as I said, which we can all relate to. But then when she's approached and decides to help out, we see her kind of emerge from that shell a little bit. Okay, here's a situation where she can be confident. Here's a situation where she can kind of rise above, and she can sort of forget about the other parts of her life where she feels like she doesn't have as much control and she's unsure of herself. And all of a sudden she has some agency. You know, she has some something about her that draws you in, where you start rooting for her and you start thinking, yeah, you go, Harley, you know, get on with your bad self kind of thing. And so, you know, as much as I don't normally care for Harley in stories like this, or stories like Joker Harley Criminal Sanity, where you strip away the zaniness or the goofiness or I guess the humor aspect. But it's humor. I guess the problem I have with it is I just don't find that kind of humor that funny. I mean, it can be in small doses, but it goes too far for me. So I think this sort of Harley that's much more grounded and much more relatable, it, you know, it doesn't have that insanity, basically, that craziness or zaniness. I think it's much more interesting as a character. I think there's much more to mine there, because when you talk about the crazy, goofy Harley, I don't feel like I've ever gotten to know anything about her below the surface, as opposed to what Cammy Garcia is doing in Criminal Sanity, what Murphy and Collins are doing here. I feel like we are getting some of that. You know, there's mentions of Harley, you know, far in the past, before she ever met the Joker, you know, things with her mother or family, and that's getting to the root of the character again. She's a damaged person. She's been through some trauma, and it kind of helps explain and inform how she becomes who she is and why she makes the decisions that she makes. And again, those are things that I find really interesting. So I have enjoyed kind of Batman White Knight universe that Sean Gordon Murphy has created. It's not my favorite kind of thing, but I thought interesting enough. And I'm not even sure why I decided to give this a read, because I, you know, when it first came out, I'm like, ah, it's Harley, whatever. But I, right from the start, you know, three or four pages in, I was like, wow, this is really, really good. And by the time I got to the end of it, I was really happy I read it. So I think it works on all levels. As far as the art goes, you know, most of the White Knight stuff has been illustrated by Sean Murphy himself. This is actually drawn by Matteo Scalera, as I mentioned. His style is very similar to Sean Gordon Murphy. So I think in that way, he's a really good choice. And I'm not sure if he's purposely trying to make his art look a little more like Sean Gordon Murphy's art. Because, I mean, I've seen Matteo's art before, and I don't remember it looking... I don't remember his style being exactly like this. So I think he's even trying to kind of mimic a little bit of the Sean Gordon Murphy style, which I, again, really appreciate it. You know, it's kind of the sharp noses, the line weights are similar, things like that. The color work, again, it's very consistent with sort of the tone and feel and palette that we've seen in previous White Knight books, you know, White Knight multiverse books from Dave Stewart. So he does a great job with the colors. They're not real bright. Even Harley's, you know, red and black costume, you know, doesn't leap off the page at you. And then the lettering from And World Designs, Troy Pateri and his proteges is done, you know, really well also. Especially in pacing the dialogue, there's one scene where Harley goes to visit Bruce in prison where it can get a little wordy, but I think that the lettering is laid out really well, and it doesn't, you know, overwhelm the art, and it's set up in such a way that it sort of paces the conversation very well, which is what lettering is supposed to do. So if you're a fan of the White Knight verse, the Batman White Knight verse, I think you're going to be really happy with this. If you haven't given it a try, if you sort of feel like I do about Harley, then I would recommend, you know, check this out. See if this is something, see if this version of Harley is one that you can kind of get behind and kind of relate to, kind of like the way that I have. And I'll say one more thing about this before I move on. This title, even if you haven't read any of the previous stories in the Batman White Knight universe, you can pick this up. There's enough clues and enough exposition early in the story that kind of gives you an idea. There's a couple little recap panels here and there that it fills you in enough to where if you haven't read any of the previous stuff, but you want to check this out, you totally can. Good job by the creative team on that one. All right, so let me move on next. I'm going to talk about another Batman book. It's Batman number 101 from writer James Tynan IV. The art is by Guillaume March. We have Tomeu Morey on colors, Clayton Cowles on letters. So, you know, we had the big Batman 100, the end of the Joker War, and now there's quite a few Batman titles out today, or Batman family of titles that are sort of the aftermath of that, the Joker War collateral damage, if you will. And I don't want to spoil Joker War for those that haven't read it or are not caught up. So I'm not going to go too much into detail, but what I will say is 101 really sets up everything going forward. You know, you hear about these big events and it's always the tagline, nothing will ever be the same. Well, for Batman, that may or may not be true. Certainly things right now are not going to be the same. Things are going to be different. Things are going to be significantly different for him in the way he approaches crime fighting, in the resources he has, in the way he relates to Gotham City, in kind of the way he's going to be able to investigate crimes. Like, all of that is going to change in a way. You could almost think of it as a back to basics for Batman. I think, and we've talked about this both on this podcast and other podcasts and YouTube channels that I've guested on, about how for maybe the past 10 or 15 years, different writers have, you know, had a chance to get on Batman, and this is the thing. And this may have been what Tynan did with Joker War, when Batman is probably certainly DC's most most popular character, maybe the most popular character in comics. And so when you're a comic creator, it's something you aspire to, right? Like everybody's got a Batman story that they want to tell. And so when you get on the book, you don't know how long you're going to be able to stay on it. Everybody wants to write Batman, both because he's Batman and because, you know, you're going to make more money. The book sells more and things like that. And so when you get your chance to be on it, you know, you're going to swing for the fences. You're going to tell your one Batman story you always wanted to tell. And the problem with that is that you may try to do too much. And I wasn't a big fan of Joker War overall. I thought it had a lot of problems structurally. And this is beyond the fact that I'm just, you know, really sick of the Joker. But I didn't think it was paced that well. I didn't think it ended that well. I just thought it had a lot of issues. And I don't necessarily blame James Tynan for that, because he sort of got jerked around a lot. Like originally, he was only going to be on until issue 99. And then things changed, and, you know, with 5G and all that kind of stuff. So God only knows what directions he was given editorially, and he was having to shift on the fly and change things around and such. And so it doesn't make for the easiest time. So if there's things that aren't, you know, 100% as good as they could be, I'm gonna chalk it up to that. But I say all that to say this. Over the last 10 or 15 years, feels like, you know, one writer after another getting their shot at Batman, with a few, you know, long runs here or there, but each writer coming on to Batman and saying, okay, well, I'm going to tell my Batman story and it's going to be epic. And then the next guy comes on and he's like, well, I've got to top what happened before. And so you're constantly leveling Batman up. You know, we've talked about who Batman is on this podcast before, who he is to us and why we think maybe he's misunderstood. And he's supposedly the second best at everything in the DC universe. And it just creates this character who, again, has technically no superpowers, unless you want to count being uber rich, but no real superpowers. And yet he's up there, you know, he's so powerful, and he's got the ability to do so much, and you can't outthink him, and you can't outplan him, and you can't outfight him. And he just, it's almost like the thing that writers used to complain about with Superman back in the Silver Age and the Bronze Age, where here's a character who's so powerful, he can move planets, he can, you know, alter orbits, he can fly into the sun. It's like, how do you tell a story? How do you challenge him? He's so powerful. What can, you know, how can you relate to him? And that's sort of where Batman is getting to, right? Like he's gotten to be so big. He touches everything in the DC universe. He's got these satellites that spy on everybody. He can defeat Superman. He can defeat Wonder Woman. He can defeat Aquaman. He's got all these contingency plans, and, you know, the ultimate planner, and he's just prepared for every contingency. And it's, in a way, it's kind of diluted the character in my mind, because, and I've heard a lot of writers say this recently also, is that you can tell any kind of story that you want with Batman. And I think in a way, while that's interesting and it opens the doors up creatively to tell any kind of story you want and put Batman in all kinds of different situations, it also goes to show, I think, that he's gotten a little bit away from his roots, and certainly some of the best grounded, more intimate Batman stories of the 70s and early 80s, where every story Batman told didn't reverberate, or every story that was told about Batman didn't reverberate, you know, across the DC universe, where, okay, there's some kind of crisis coming up. It's, you know, multiversal shattering, and, you know, the source wall is broken, or Darkseid is, you know, finally got the anti-life quotient, or whatever it is. Right now you could look at, okay, well, the Batman who laughs, you know, is now leveled up and he's working with Perpetua, and even surpassing Perpetua, and going to destroy the multiverse. And who's right there at the center of the story? Batman, right? Like these earth shattering, huge events, huge stories. And Batman is right there. And again, while it's cool that somebody that doesn't have any superpowers can raise himself up, and you can look at him like that, like, well, he really is a hero. he's just like us, except he's trained himself to the absolute peak of, you know, physical perfection, and his mind is, you know, as sharp as anyone's, and he's, you know, super intelligent and all that, and it's something to aspire to. On the other hand, it's like, well, how do you relate to that? You know, the story has gotten so big and the character has gotten so big. And so I kind of feel like what Tynan may be doing here is dialing that all back. Let's get back to basics a little bit. Let's set Batman up. Let's set Bruce Wayne up where, let's move on from that. Let's make things smaller. Let's make things more intimate. Let's get back to why he does what he does, who he is, what matters to him, you know, protecting the people of Gotham, and dial that back just a little bit. It's certainly still going to be impactful stories and big stories, I think, but I feel like maybe it's not, okay, well, Batman's going to go face villain X and he's going to need a giant half dinosaur, half bulldozer type Batmobile to set everything up perfectly so he can defeat this guy and stop the dam from exploding or whatever it is, right? It's like he's not going to have the resources that he's had in the past where he can just, you know, flip a switch and here's this cool gadget and he goes and saves the day. It seems like it's going to be getting back to basics. And the reason I'm hedging there a little bit is because I don't know if it'll work. I don't know. Like I said, he's been leveling up so much over the last 4 years. I don't know if you can put that genie back in the bottle. I don't know if fans are going to accept it. I don't know if it works. I don't know if it, you know, technically you're making Batman a little bit smaller. I mean, I don't ever really remember back when I was reading Batman stories in the late 80s and early 90s of feeling like, here I'm reading this Batman story and I'm aware that he's one of the most, I don't want to say powerful, but one of the most influential, let's say, one of the most important characters in the DCU. And it certainly feels like that now. It feels like anything that happens to Batman in the Batman books, you could see consequences for that in every other book in DCU, whether that be, you know, the Justice League or in Superman titles or what have you, because things that happen in the Batman book are just super important because it's Batman, because he's such a linchpin of the DC universe, you know. But back when I was reading those stories, whether it was written by Jim Starlin or John Byrne or, you know, whoever, I was just reading a Batman story, you know, like 10 Nights of the Beast. That was just a Batman story, him taking on the KGB beast for the first time. And it was a great story and, you know, really cool with, you know, great Jim Aparo art that only affected Batman. There weren't any other effects. And they weren't stories that, like Tom King's recent run, where, you know, it was basically one long story that went on for 89 issues. Wasn't like that. It was, you know, a two-parter here or a four-parter there, every once in a while maybe a six-parter, and the stories just felt smaller and more intimate, and Batman felt more contained. Like you kind of could understand him a little more. He didn't seem so larger than life and so abstract, you know. And you certainly can point to Grant Morrison's run where, you know, he really leveled up Batman to the point where, okay, well, let's not just have one Batman. Let's have all these different Batmen across the world with, you know, Batman Incorporated, just taking that idea of Batman, you know, to the nth degree. And again, I think Tynan may be trying to dial back on that. And so again, we'll see how it works. I don't know if it will. I don't know if fans will accept it. I don't know if fans will like it, but I kind of feel like that's what he might do. And so that's why, even though I know other people are jumping off the Batman book because they felt like Tynan didn't do a good job with Joker War, sales have never been higher. I mean, sales are really good. So it'll be interesting to see if people buy into this new take on Batman. And then as far as other story beats, again, I just don't want to spoil. I always want to keep this spoiler free, but it was in the solicits that Grifter shows up in here, and there's a talk that Grifter and Batman have that sort of hints at some other possible Wildstorm involvement in the regular DCU. So I know that's been hinted at as well. It was maybe going to be a part of 5G, and now 5G has gone by the wayside, but it looks like we may be seeing more, again, not for sure, but we may be seeing more of some of the Wildstorm content come into the regular DCU. And then the last thing I'll mention about the issue is it also sort of sets up a new kind of status with Batman and Catwoman. I know next month we have the Bat and the Cat, the first supposedly out of continuity issue of the Bat and the Cat series, which is not supposed to be in regular continuity, but that could change as things always do. But it's Tom King and Clay Mann kind of finishing the story of Batman and Catwoman that King was telling in his Batman run. And so I'm not sure if this new kind of status that is talked about between Bruce and Selina here is to kind of let that happen, because again, that's supposed to be out of continuity. But maybe Tynan just needs to take Selina off the table for a little while, because she's got her own stuff going on in her book, which I'm going to talk about in a little bit. So maybe it's just, again, stripping away the things that Batman has had to help him out recently and getting back to basics. So I did enjoy the issue. Probably one of my, I don't want to say favorite, but I think one of the technically better issues that Tynan has done since he's come on the book. The Guillaume March art is done really well. He's got a lot of big panels, a lot of great action scenes, and the colors, again, done really well. It's Batman, so it's not super primary, but it's bright where it needs to be and suitably kind of dark where it needs to be. So all in all, like I said, one of the issues of the Tynan run that I've enjoyed more than most of his run so far. All right, up next, I'm going to talk about Catwoman, like I just mentioned. So this is issue 23. It's written by, I'm sorry, this is issue 26, and it's written by Ram V. We have pencils by Fernando Blanco, colors by FCO Plasencia, letters by Tom Napolitano. And this plays off right off of Catwoman 25 that had a few different stories from Ram V, where the first story sort of tied into the Joker War, and then we had another one that kind of set Catwoman up for what comes next for her, and then one that was a little more just kind of for fun, if you will. And so this story here in 26 kind of picks up off that second story in 25, where we see Catwoman back in Alleytown. She's sort of setting herself up to be the head of the crime in Alleytown, kind of the big cheese there, if you will. And there are still consequences to be dealt with in terms of the Joker War. So this technically is a Joker War collateral damage tie-in. And we saw in Joker War that Catwoman did something to some of the other criminals, some of the high-ranking criminals in Gotham City, that they're not just going to let slide. And so basically there's a bounty out on Catwoman. She's in a very bad position right now in terms of the way the other criminal heads of crime or what have you in Gotham look at her. They're not going to just let it lie. They're going to go after her. And so we're introduced to a new character here that's going to be trying to take Catwoman out, while Catwoman is trying to get the lay of the land in Alleytown and figure out what she needs to do to show everybody that she's the one that runs Alleytown. So again, it kind of does make sense that her and Bruce would have time apart, because she needs to deal with this sort of stuff. So that's kind of where the story's going as far as this particular issue, and what I love about what Ram V's doing with the title, and I mentioned this when I talked about 25. He's telling a crime story, you know, kind of like Miles to Go, where it's very grounded and it's very realistic. And, you know, obviously it's Catwoman and they're superheroes and that kind of thing, but we don't really get much of that. This is very much a street level story. This is very much Catwoman doing what she needs to do to take care of her family, to take care of her friends. And so it's relatable in that way. And, you know, the dialogue, the tone, and I think I said this when I talked about 25, the voice that Ram V gives Catwoman is just dead on perfect. You know, she's not over the top. She's not super whiny. She's just, she comes across as competent and capable and intelligent and knowing what she wants. And it's probably some of my favorite Catwoman that I've ever read. Like, Catwoman's a title that I come in and out because I'll read it for a while. It's like, I want to like it. I, you know, like, character's interesting to me. But I'll read it for a while and I'll just be like, okay, she's stealing something else. And, you know, she's whining about this, or she's, you know, completely over the top. Kind of like the Michelle Pfeiffer version, you know, this sexy minx kind of thing. It's just, it's very two-dimensional. She doesn't seem real to me. And so I end up dropping it, and then it's a tie-in or whatever. I like the cover, let me pick it up or what have you. What Ram V has been doing, and Joelle Jones did a pretty good job as well, but I think Ram V goes even further. He grounds her in such a way that she is relatable, you know, bringing her sister in, to give that touchstone that you can relate to, and family's important to her, and just how confident she is. I think it's, like I said, some of the best Catwoman I've ever read. And so I'm really excited to see what happened. And I can't ever remember being super excited for a Catwoman comic. Usually when I'm picking up Catwoman or looking forward to Catwoman, it's because of the art. But that's not the case here. And that's not to say the art is bad by Fernando Blanco by any stretch of the imagination. It's really great art. And especially the color work is done really, really well by FCO Plasencia. It's not too bright where you would go, you know, say it's primary and it's very superhero-ish, but it's not too dark either. He plays in the middle in kind of a palette that I really enjoy, because it's brighter than you would expect for, you know, something I would call crime noir, which is sort of what the story is. And that is still helps it live in that kind of superhero world, but dark enough to keep it grounded. So I really, really enjoying Catwoman. If you're like me, one of those people that could never really get into Catwoman, I would suggest picking it up and giving it a chance, because it's really, really good. It kind of reminds me of, you know, the kind of stories that Michael Mann tells, you know, if you're familiar with any of his work, Heat, or Collateral, those kind of stylish crime movies, heist movies that are just a lot of fun with a lot of action. It feels like that's what Ram V is building toward here, because he just, like I said, he nails the voice of Selena so well. It's really, really great. So I'm really, really glad. Again, Catwoman was a title that I had dropped, then I picked up 25 because it was a Joker War tie-in. Really liked what Ram V did, and definitely had to pick up the next issue to see where it was going. And I was really glad I did. It's definitely going on my pull list. I'll be reading Catwoman 27 as soon as I can get my hands on it. So, all right. Up next is Death Metal tie-in. It's Dark Knight's Death Metal, Robin King. So written by Peter J. Tomasi. We've got art by Riley Rossmo, colors by Yvonne Plasencia, and letters by Rob Lee. And then there is a backup story starring Signal and a lot of the other Robins, that's written by somebody whose name I was not that familiar with. And I think he might be one of the creators from the DC Talent Workshop. But the writer's Tony Patrick. The artist is Daniel Sampier, who is somebody whose art I really, really enjoy. We've got colors by Adriana Lucas, who was my colorist of the year for 2019, who's just incredible and does a great job in the story as well. And then letters by Anne World Design. So not going to get too spoilerish here. Robin King is basically just another version of Bruce Wayne from the Dark Multiverse, who kind of went completely evil at a very young age. He like a lot of the other characters, the other Batman from the Dark Multiverse, it's, you know, some circumstances happened where Bruce kind of took the wrong path, or somebody died, or his world was being destroyed, and he ended up merging with, you know, the Flash, or with Doomsday, or with Aquaman, or whomever, right? Atrocitus, and then with that, and all that kind of thing was in the first Dark Knight's Metal story, and then in Death Metal we had him merging with the Batmobile, him merging with Gotham City, him merging with the T-Rex, and, you know, really kind of over the top sort of stuff. We also have this idea of the Robin King, who was a young Bruce Wayne, who is, you know, the age of Robin, you know, the sidekick, who's gone completely off the rails. It's not ever really explained why. He's just pure evil, basically. But he's still Bruce Wayne. He's still got that superior intellect and that technical know-how and the ability to always have a way to defeat the heroes through, you know, whatever means necessary. So whether that's, you know, kryptonite to defeat Superman, or some kind of anti-speed force thing to defeat Flash, whatever it might be, you know, he's got it all there in his belt. So this issue is really kind of showcasing the abilities that Robin King has, and also how he's sort of independent from the Batman who laughs much more than a lot of the other characters in the Dark Knight Death Metal story, especially because when you look at all the groblins, the Robins that the Batman who laughs has used as his sidekick, he's gathered all these Robins from different Dark Multiverse universes, and he's exposed them to something, and they're basically like his little demon sidekicks. And he sees the Robin King as one of those, because to him, he's just a Robin. Batman who laughs doesn't see him as a Batman. You know, the Batman who laughs obviously is sort of the leader of all the evil Batman of the Dark Multiverse, but he certainly sees them as higher up than the grobbins, the groblins, or whatever you call them. Those are kind of the grunts, you know, the peons, if you will. And Robin King's like, I'm not that. I'm so much more. I'm not a Robin. I'm a Batman. I'm just choosing to call myself Robin. And there's reasons that for that are explained in the story. And so a lot of what we see here, it fleshes out the character a lot more. And it leads into Dark Knight's Death Metal number 5, where we're going to see more of the Robin King. So that's all well and good. I think it's written and paced well by Peter J. Tomasi. I would come to expect that from him. That doesn't surprise me. The problem I have with it is the character himself. There's not really an explanation for why Bruce would go bad at such a young age. I guess that's just the Dark Multiverse. People are evil there, I guess. I don't know. So that's more, I just don't find the character that interesting. And he's a little bit too powerful for my taste, but, you know, kind of feel the same way about the Batman who laughs. Just, it's not my thing, but I can see plenty of people loving this. You know, if you like Dark Knight's Death Metal, if you dig the Batman who laughs, I mean, this is all in that same sort of tone and feel. And again, it all makes sense. It doesn't really do much for me. And the other thing I didn't like about it is it's Riley Rosmo art. So, you know, I'm not gonna, you know, complain about Rosmo's art in terms of the technical aspect of it. He tells the story well, and his layouts within the panel, the transitions, all that stuff's really great. I just don't like his style. So aesthetically, it doesn't work for me. And there's a couple of things. So I don't care for his line work or his anatomy or the, you know, aesthetic that he uses when he draws things, the exaggeration and things like that. I also don't care for the textures that he uses. And I really don't care for the way he kind of haphazardly just slaps panels on the page. So for me, it's really, I wouldn't choose to read a story normally that Rosmo draws because I just don't enjoy his art. But I'm reading the death metal story, and Robin King is an important, you know, part of that story. So I read this because I wanted to know, and, you know, I'm glad I did. Cause like I said, it fleshes out the character a lot, but it was a chore for me to get through it. Cause I just don't care for the art at all. The backup story, I enjoyed a lot more in terms of the art, especially the color work. You know, Daniel Sampir, as I mentioned, he's an artist I enjoy. The color work I thought was spectacular. So once again, we have a Batman who is merged with some other, it's more than one character this time, not to be too spoilery, but a Batman who's merged with other things, who's greenish in color, and that green color that Adriana Lucas gets to play with is awesome, because it's like he's glowing. Like when I first saw the splash page for the story, I was like, is this Batman and Chemo merged together, right? Like the walking, you know, mix of green chemical that kind of glows. It's not, but that's the bright green color that it kind of looks like, or it kind of pops off the page. And man, Lucas is just, he is next level when it comes to coloring, man. He is spectacular. So the story is interesting enough. I mean, it's Duke and some of the other Bat family, and we're kind of getting the origin of this different sort of Batman, Quietus, he's called. I'm assuming we're going to see more of him at some point, maybe even after the death metal story, because his origin and who he is, it just seems like it could be really important. Seems like there's a lot of story there to mine. And then the story has some other themes as well about family and teamwork. And it also sets up Duke in a way where it kind of changes his current status. So I have a feeling the story is kind of set up for more things to come down the line, but I guess we'll have to wait and see. So, all right, let me move on to the next book that I want to talk about. And that's Daredevil number 23, written by Chip Zdarsky. Art is by Marco Cicchetto. Colors by Marcio Menez. Letters by Clayton Cowles. So this is Truth or Dare Part 3, where Matt Murdock, Daredevil, is really faced with a tough situation. He's about to go on trial for manslaughter. As Daredevil, he was able to do some legal maneuvering and be tried as Daredevil. Rather than Matt Murdock, he didn't have to reveal his identity and that sort of thing. So before he goes away, in case he does have to go away, he wants to kind of set things up as well as he can. So he's been working on ways to kind of stop the Kingpin, who's still mayor of New York City, as well as these two brothers who are buying up parts of Hell's Kitchen that are in the criminal underworld and using the property for nefarious means. And we see in this particular issue, he teams up with Spider-Man to kind of put Kingpin and his cronies on notice that even if Daredevil goes away, that somebody's going to be there watching him, and they kind of need to watch their backs. So there's a couple of pages devoted to the relationship between Daredevil and Spider-Man, which I always think is undermined. And by that, I mean, it's not, there's so much there it's not mined enough by writers. They don't take advantage of that relationship enough. And over the years, they've had their kind of ups and downs, and that's addressed here by Zdarsky. So I love the fact that Chip is digging into Marvel history and kind of explaining the relationship between these two, because at times they've been really close, at times they've been at odds with each other. And I think it's great that Zdarsky is acknowledging all of that and setting up sort of a new fresh start for these two. And there's a couple of really great looking scenes with them really kind of having a heart to heart. We also saw at the end of last issue that Daredevil's former girlfriend was summoned by Foggy Nelson to come and help out with Daredevil's trial. And obviously that doesn't necessarily sit right with Daredevil, because when him and Kirsten split up, it wasn't necessarily by either of their choice. It was sort of circumstances. I don't want to get into all of that because it's long and complicated and involved, and it's kind of spoilery if you haven't read Charles Soule's run. So, but it's putting Matt in kind of a tough position, and Kirsten wants to know. So she is to help defend Daredevil, and she wants to know, okay, well, we're going to defend him to the best of our abilities, but if you're here defending him, Foggy, and I'm here defending him, you know, the person who would be best at it defending Daredevil is going to be Matt. Matt knows him best, because Kirsten doesn't know that Matt and Daredevil are one and the same. And so it seems like there's going to be some consequences for that as well. And so again, I just really have been enjoying what Zdarsky has done on Daredevil. He's not a writer whose work I always enjoy. A lot of the early work I read for him, I didn't like, to the point where I'm like, man, I'm not going to like anything this guy does. But lately, between his Stillwater series, which I thought the first issue was okay. I don't even remember if I talked about it on the podcast, but I'm going to talk about issue two here in a little bit. But between that and Daredevil, yeah, I mean, he is writing a really, really great Daredevil. There's still a couple things that I have a problem with, but they were kind of addressed early on, and that's kind of gone by the wayside. But this is going to go down as a really great era of Daredevil, because Zdarsky is saying true to the character. He is sort of putting him through some situations and such that sort of have been done before, but he's coming at it from a different angle. Like, you can talk about, well, okay, if Daredevil goes to, you know, prison and he's, you know, stripped of his secret identity, things like that. We've seen Daredevil in prison before. You've seen him lose his secret identity before. So these aren't, you know, 100% fresh and original ideas. But Zdarsky, the voice he gives Daredevil, the tone of the book, the emotion he infuses in the story is so good, and it sucks you in to the point where you don't care that some of these ideas have been approached before, because again, you're so grounded and you're so invested that you can't wait to see what happens next. And he's doing it in such a way that it is different. It is coming at it from a different point of view, and it feels real, and it feels natural, and it feels organic. It doesn't feel like a retread. And so, you know, in a way, you've got to give Zdarsky even more credit than him writing, you know, brand new original idea. The fact that he's putting Matt in some situations that Matt's been in before, but yet it still feels fresh. I mean, that's really great writing. And Marco Cecchetto on the art has been spectacular throughout. If there's anything about the art that I wouldn't even say I don't care for, but I will say that the page layouts they could be a little more dynamic. I'll put it that way. I mean, the transition and the visual storytelling is great from panel to panel. There's good emotion in the faces. The action scenes are handled well, but you pretty much just get rectangles everything is just a rectangle. And so if there's anywhere where he could improve, I think the art could be a little more dynamic. If he used, I don't know, maybe some collage pieces or superimposed some characters. And again, very minor. I only bring it up to say that he could be even better, even though I feel like it's really, really good. And the color work, it's fine. It's certainly a kind of a brighter palette. It's not that real gritty, dark palette that we had in the Charles Soule run with the Ron Garney art that Matt Miller brought to the book. Marcio Menez is giving it. It's still dark enough that it feels grounded, you know, lots of reds, lots of oranges. So it still feels very much like Daredevil, but it's there's not heavy, heavy use of shadow and texture like we saw in the Garney run. So this palette suits Marco Cecchetto's art style better than that darker sort of coloring would. All right, up next we have Fantastic Four number 25 from writer Dan Slott. The art is by R.B. Silva, colors by Jesus Arbatov, and there is a second story with art by Paco Paco Medina, with color by Marcio Menez. So it's sort of an anniversary issue. Not going to get too much into the details at all. I should also mention there's a great Mark Brooks regular cover on issue 25. But this is a typical Fantastic Four story in that we're dealing with big ideas, big bombastic scientific adventure. And Dr. Doom makes an appearance. We've got all members of the Fantastic Four accounted for to sort of handle this epic disaster, this epic event that happens. And it sort of takes all hands on deck to solve the problem. But in solving the problem, they sort of create another problem. And it's a problem that's very Fantastic Four-ish in its idea and execution and consequences. So although technically they solved the problem, they sort of created another one that may be worse than the initial problem. Or it may be that they only delayed the initial problem by sort of morphing it into this solution / problem that they've got. So I won't say it changes the status quo of the Fantastic Four going forward, but it does change some things. They will be relocating. They won't be on Yancey Street anymore. And they're going to have to deal with the consequences and the ramifications of what happens in this issue. And it's a big enough idea that if Dan Slott wants, it could sort of set the tone for any number of stories. It could be a year, 2 years worth of stories that can all come from this one idea as the team and the family has to sort of deal with the consequences and find a more long-term solution. The second story that I mentioned with the Paco Medina art ties in with The Watcher and the original Nick Fury and something that's been going on there. Don't know why it's in Fantastic Four. I mean, it almost feels like when you read this, it's a prelude to another big Marvel event, right? Like here's the sequel to Original Sin, if you will. So that might not be the case. Maybe it's an event that's just going to be in the Fantastic Four books. Maybe it's a storyline or an arc. Not sure. It almost feels like because this was issue 25 and a larger size issue, they're just like, okay, well, we need a second story. Okay, well, we're going to be doing this sequel to Original Sin. Let's throw it in Fantastic Four because they're going to be involved in that. And, you know, we'll see what happens. So it's interesting enough. I mean, if you read Original Sin, if you really like that, you're definitely going to want to pick this up because it does sort of continue that story or with what happened with Nick Fury at the end of that story. I'm not going to go into it, but if you read it, you know what I'm talking about. And it changes that. It changes the ramifications of original Sid. Nick Fury is no longer the same in the same place when we get to the end of this story. So and there are things that are mentioned in the story that, again, feel like they could have big ramifications either just in the Fantastic Four title or for all of the Marvel Universe going forward, just depending on how Marvel wants to spin it, like how consequential, how big do they want the story to be that we're seeing begin here. So, all right, up next I have Iron Man number 2 from writer Christopher Cantwell. Art is by Kafu. Colors are by Frank D'Armata. Letters are by Joe Caramagna. So we are getting a Tony Stark that is the antithesis of Robert Downey Jr. We're getting a Tony Stark that has doubt, that is questioning himself, that is not super confident. And it reminds me so much of one of my favorite eras of Iron Man, when Tony kind of drowned himself in alcohol for the second time, not the demon in the bottle storyline, but you know, when he gave up being Iron Man and James Rhodes took over in right around 172, I think it was. And Tony ended up hitting rock bottom. And there's a really famous cover. I want to say it's issue 179, might be 178. But it's Tony. He's in a suit, a black suit, white shirt, black tie. And that's all. That's all he has. You know, obviously shoes, what have you. But he's out in New York in a blizzard, you know, outside. And he's a wino, basically. He's an alcoholic. He's out on the streets. He's like homeless. And he's in this blizzard, you know, snow falling around him. And on the cover, he's in this little alley. And written on the building, it says, in the morning, Tony Stark will either be sober or he will be dead. And that was Tony basically in that issue hitting rock bottom. And then leading up to 200 with the Silver Centurion armor that a lot of people don't care for, but I kind of like nostalgia, I guess. But it's a silver and red armor that he first donned in issue 200 when he took on Obadiah Stane, the Ironmonger. From that point, from that hitting rock bottom, 179 or what have you, to 200 with him sort of regaining confidence slowly. But he questioned himself a lot. He doubted himself. He had to learn who he was. I mean, at one point, James Rhodes offers him the armor back, and Tony says, no, I'll never wear that armor again. There was just too much emotional and trauma and pain and problems mixed up when he was wearing that armor. And, you know, you can talk about, well, he eventually became Iron Man again anyway, but he wore different armor. And, you know, you can talk about the psychological ramifications of that and making excuses and, you know, that sort of thing. But the point is that's a Tony Stark that's relatable and that's grounded and that you can root for. And it was a long journey. And even though in 200, he, you know, donned the armor again, there were still ramifications. And going up through in the 200s, there was a storyline where, you know, obviously we had the armor wars where, again, Tony was forced to question himself and his technology was being used for crime and to inflict pain. And that angered him. And again, he was faced with the mistakes that he made and things that he needed to do in order to protect his property. And then further on, we learned that the armor was damaging him and he became paralyzed at one point. So again, it was exploring those ideas. You know, go back to the very first stories about the Marvel age and you know, Stan Lee himself saying, well, the reason that these superheroes are so popular, Fantastic Four, Incredible Hulk, Spider-Man and such, is you're telling stories about superheroes with hang-ups. That's a quote. That's what Stan, you know, back then, hang-ups, problems, issues. And so it made them more real. It made them more grounded. You could relate to them because, you know, Peter's having trouble dating or Peter's getting picked on in high school, you know, just like us. Well, the same thing with Iron Man. You know, he struggles with addiction or he struggles with doubt. He's not, you know, the RDJ version that, you know, cracks jokes and has no problems and, you know, is just larger than life. And you know, maybe he does have issues, personal, you know, personality issues and such, but he doesn't, you know, acknowledge them. What Cantwell is doing in his Iron Man run so far is he's tearing Tony down. He's all the way back to the beginning where he doesn't know. I mean, he says it right in the issue, like, I don't know who I am. And like, is Tony Stark Iron Man? Am I just the superhero? Am I the basically the, I don't know what you would want to call it, the flesh filling of this Iron Man armor, right? Like I only matter because of the technology. Or am I actually, you know, a person? Who am I without the armor? There's all these questions. There's all these doubts. And it's fantastic because we're getting Iron Man and Tony Stark back to a place where once Cantwell finishes tearing him down, he can build him back up, but build him up with some humility to make him, I think, more interesting of a character. Kind of like I was talking about with Batman earlier, you get him back to basics and then you can relate to them more. They become more interesting because they are flawed, right? As opposed to, oh, it's fun to read because he's a super genius and he's got all this technology and everything's over the top and he's cracking jokes and what have you. I mean, to me, that gets old. And so the fact that he's questioning himself and he's trying to discover himself, it feels so much more like my Tony Stark, like the Tony Stark that I read, you know, way back before the first Iron Man movie, before he was super popular, probably before a lot of people knew who Iron Man was. And so maybe it's only going to work for me and people like me who, you know, come from that era, that it feels familiar and it feels more grounded. But I'm really enjoying it. So I'm curious what other people's reaction is going to be. I haven't seen a lot. I mean, this is only the second issue. So I'll be curious to see what reviews look like tomorrow for the second issue. We also know it's been teased that Korvac of the Korvac saga, one of the most powerful and interesting villains of the Marvel Universe, who's been criminally underutilized over the years, is making a comeback. And we see a little bit of that here. A little bit of how he came back, and it's teased that we're going to learn in issue 3 that Tony's going to discover that he's kind of behind some of the problems that Tony's been having so far. I also really like having Patsy Walker, Hellcat, here. She's a female character, and so often Tony plays well off female characters, more so than male. And it might not necessarily be the case because of the way Cantwell sort of breaking him down emotionally. But even when he's the happy-go-lucky, super, you know, ultra-confident RDJ version, I think you do get more insight into who he is when he interacts with female characters as opposed to male. Male, he's putting up a front, kind of macho guy sort of thing, cracking jokes and what have you. With the female, you get a little bit more perspective. But what I like about the fact that it's Patsy Walker is there's not a lot of history there. There's not, you know, if you brought in Pepper Potts, then all of a sudden you've got the baggage and things like that. Bethany Cabe, same thing. You've got a lot of baggage. So the fact that it's Hellcat, it's Patsy Walker, and she doesn't really put up with any of his crap, it's a great foil for Tony. And then Kafu's art, it's spectacular. I mean, it's Kafu's art. He's got very fine lines, and I think it helps to sort of ground Tony and ground the armor as well, because he doesn't come across as super powerful. He looks a little more fragile, if that's a thing. I mean, he certainly still looks like Iron Man, and he still looks powerful, but it's a little bit softer, and it plays well with the sort of story that that Christopher Cantwell is telling, and how vulnerable Tony feels. So I thought the second issue was really great. If I have any complaint at all about the first couple issues so far, it's a little bit of the pacing. And I think it's just because Christopher's so excited and wants to get where he's going. And you don't want to take too long to get there, because people can, they can get bored really quickly. So I'm not saying the pacing bad necessarily, but I just, with two issues in, I'm just not sure. It might be one of those things where let's get the first arc kind of under our belt and go back and then see where this big story beats are, you know, where the peaks and valleys are, and see if it works. Cause I'm unsure about the pacing right now, if this is paced well or not. And so I think there's always room for improvement. So really, really great issue though. Really enjoyed the second issue, and very anxious to see Tony versus Korvac. That just sounds like a really fun time. All right, so let me move on to the next book I'm going to talk about. It's Juggernaut number 2, written by Fabian Nicieza. We have art by Ron Garney, colors by Matt Milla, and letters by Joe Sabino. So we've got that Ron Garney, Matt Milla artistic team, same one we saw on Charles Soule's Daredevil run. I'm not sure what the point, I'm not sure what the end game is for Juggernaut. You know, with the X-Men corner of the Marvel Universe being completely reconfigured, and they're over on their own in Krakoa, Juggernaut's always sort of lived in that corner of the Marvel Universe. He can't anymore because he's technically not a mutant. He's not allowed on the island. And he's been working for Damage Incorporated. And is he a villain? Is he not? Is he a hero slash villain? Is he a villain slash hero? Is he somewhere in between? Is he an anti-hero? Is that what the point of the series is? So I kind of feel like we're supposed to be rooting for the Juggernaut, but I feel like we haven't gotten enough of him and his motivations and who, like, I don't know who he is. I don't know if he knows who he is. And so maybe that's the point of the series. Let's find out who the Juggernaut is. But then at the same time, when you do this sort of thing and you end up rooting for the Juggernaut and kind of understanding his motivations, and he repents from his bad ways, you know, you can think of like Sandman or Absorbing Man, making these same sort of decisions. All of a sudden you're like, here's these classic Marvel villains, and they're all sort of heroes or anti-heroes now. It's like, you don't have any villains left. Sometimes villains can just stay villains. But if this is the direction Marvel wants to go, they own the character. I'm not one to tell them they can't do that. And it's not like it's not a good story and it's not interesting. Just wonder about the long-term goals here. So in this issue, he fights the Hulk. It's handled relatively well, I would say. And we get sort of some ramifications that there's a whole support group of people that just want to basically be heard about the way the Hulk has hurt them, has had a negative impact on their life. And then that gets sort of transposed into another situation where we have to look at things from a different perspective. And then in the end, you start wondering, okay, well, is the Juggernaut a hero? Is the Juggernaut not a hero? You know, he took on the Hulk. He's helping out Damage Incorporated. It looks like he's trying to make up for the things he's done in the past. Is it enough? Do motivations matter? Like, all that is on the table here. But I don't know that it's being overtly examined. So I don't know that this is being done in the best way. I mean, it's interesting enough. I'm going to give it one more issue to see if I hang on for more, or if I let it go by the wayside. The art, it's Ron Garney and Matt Milla. So it's very visceral. It's very gritty art. It's not, there aren't clean lines, but I think the battle between Hulk and And Juggernaut is handled really well. And I will say that it's impactful. I think Matt Miller's colors do a good job of really bringing that emotional weight to the story. So this one was okay. Definitely wasn't at the top of my list when it comes to books that I read this week. And like I said, I'll be on board for one more to see where it goes, if I'm going to hang out for more than that. All right, up next is Justice League number 55 from writer Joshua Williamson. We have pencils by Robson Rocha, inks by Daniel Enriquez, colors by Romulo Fajardo Jr., and letters by Tom Napolitano. This is a Dark Knight's death metal tie-in. We're sort of seeing this this death metal version of the Justice League as they're on their journey to try to free the Legion of Doom so that they will no longer be powering Perpetua's chair. And we saw last issue where Lex tried to join them and help guide them, and they didn't want anything to do with him. And then because of that choice, they sort of walked into a trap in the Valley of the Starros. And so we see the ramifications of that in this issue, and we see what Lex's plan is and whether or not this team is going to be able to even make it to the throne of Perpetua to kind of complete their mission. So one thing I was struck with in this issue, and I think this issue, if you look at it as a singular story, it's very indicative of the Dark Knight death metal story overall. We're not doing anything new here. We're not, you know, telling a new story that's innovative or seeing characters in new ways. Yes, this is sort of the post-apocalyptic version, this nightmare dark multiverse version of the DC universe and of the Earth. I get that. Sort of these Mad Max versions of Nightwing and what have you. But at the end of the day, it's, you know, a big threat that's threatening the DC universe. And it's a bunch of heroes banding together to go and undertake their little, you know, part of the mission, the overall big mission to set up the ability for the heroes to win the day. So nothing really new here, nothing groundbreaking, nothing that makes you say, oh, I'm super excited to read this. I can't wait to see what happens next. And that's not to say it's a bad issue. I mean, there are certainly a few really, really great scenes, especially one between Hawk Girl and our Hawk Woman and Lex. But at the end of the day, you know, we're not seeing anything new. And I certainly don't feel like this is something you have to read. I mean, obviously, if you're, you know, huge fan of death metal and you love everything that's been going on, then you're going to want to pick this up to get, you know, more of the story. But I think that whatever happens here, whatever happens with this version of the Justice League and whether or not they complete their mission, it's all going to be referenced in the regular Dark Knight death metal series. I'm more curious to see what happens to the Justice League after this, right? Like, we know death metal is going to come to an end. And then in December, all the Justice League titles are going to tie into the Endless Winter. And then January, February, we have Future State. So what does the Justice League title look like in March? Who's on the team? Who's the creative team, most importantly? And, you know, what's going to be the state of the DCU? Is Justice League as a title going to be super important to the DCU? Is it not? Like, that's where that's where my head's at. So this is okay. It's, again, it's not anything new. It's not anything groundbreaking. You know, Joshua Williamson, he's a good writer. So the dialogue and the pacing, all that is fine. The art from Robson Roach is really, really good, actually. Especially love the Starro. My favorite thing is how he draws this sort of death metal version of Starfire. She looks awesome. I'm not so much a fan of the design of Nightwing here. The Mad Max version of Nightwing doesn't really do it for me, but really dig the way he draws Starfire for sure. So yeah, I mean, the color work is good. Lettering is fine. But again, it's just not, it's one of those issues where even the little twist at the end, you can see coming a mile away because it's not anything that hasn't been done before. So, all right, let me move on to the next book. It's Maestro number 3, written by Peter David. Art is by Herman Peralta. Colors are by Jesus Arbatov. Then there's a backup, also written by Peter David, that has art by Dale Keown with letters by Jason, or colors rather, by Jason Keith. And then letters for both stories are by Ariana Maher. I started off really, really digging Maestro. Like, the first issue I thought was absolutely spectacular, and I expected us to get this story about Bruce as the Hulk waking up in this post-apocalyptic world and being faced with really tough choices and sort of being forced down the path with agonizing decisions of becoming the Maestro. And it has not been that at all. It felt like that's where we were going after the first issue. Second issue was sort of set up for this issue where we see Bruce as Hulk really take his first step to becoming the Maestro, like make conscious decisions that, okay, I'm going to do this. And what this is from the outside looking in is wrong. Like, he's things that he does in this issue. There's no other way to say it than they're just wrong. But where my disappointment lies is there's not really getting a good insight into why he's making those decisions. You can go back and read issue 1 and 2 and you can sort of see the seeds being planted, but it's all superficial. It's not really examined in depth. And I'm not saying that's wrong, that Peter David is not examining it in depth. That was an expectation I had when I read the first issue, because it seemed to me that that's where we were going to go, and I was very interested in that. Instead, what we're getting is much more of sort of an action story, a story that's much more on the surface, and it's fun, and it's bombastic, and it's over the top, and it's interesting, but it's not as in depth. It's not as thought provoking as I thought it would be. There's not a lot of material here where I'm going, okay, he made that decision, and let me think about if I was in that position, if I would make the same decision. I look at the decisions he's making, and I just go, well, that's wrong. And being that he's Hulk, being that he's Bruce Banner, I see him as a hero. It's a little bit incongruous for me. It doesn't necessarily make sense. The other thing about this issue, and I don't know why this is, the art looked different to me. The art in the first couple of issues I thought was really great. Here we have the same creative team, but the art in this issue, the colors seemed more muted and the line work didn't look quite as sharp. And so I don't know if they're doing that purposefully, but it just didn't feel the art was as good, at least for some of the pages. There's a scene where Bruce walks into a lab in Alchemex that looks much more similar to some of the art that we've seen previously. And then the little vignette, you know, I talked about how great the little relics backup was in issue 2. This one is great as well. It's awesome to see the Dale Keown art, especially him drawing a future version of Rick Jones. This one's shorter than the other one. It's only 3 pages. It gives us a little more background into kind of things that have happened between, the now time and the time when the Hulk is awoken and is on this journey to become Maestro. Sort of fill in the blank type stories, but it's also really, really poignant. And again, I think part of the reason I enjoy it so much is just seeing that Dale Keown art. So I'm still on board with Maestro. I'm still really enjoying it. It's just not necessarily what I expected it to be. And again, that's me bringing expectations. So that's not a knock on it at all. And it's been wildly popular. It's been like a runaway hit for Marvel, to the point where they have announced that there's going to be a sequel to this called Maestro War and Pax, coming in January from, I think, from the same creative team. Or, I mean, I know it's Peter David. It might be somebody else on art. Now that I think about it, might not be Herman Peralta. So, but yeah, definitely looking forward to that. So, all right, let's move on to the next book. Nightwing number 75, who is Dick Grayson, written by Dan Jurgens. We have art by Travis Moore and Ronan Cliquet, colors by Nick Filardi, letters by Ann World Designs. This is another Joker War aftermath tie-in, if you will. And it's sort of the aftermath of the ramifications of Dick Grayson getting his memory back. And it's 75 issue 75, so it's anniversary issue. It's a 40 pager, and basically it begins with Dick not sure who he is, and it finishes with him having a at least on the surface having an idea of who he is. He sort of goes on this journey of not rediscovering who he is, but kind of admitting to himself or the realizations of who he is and who he wants to be moving forward. And you know, can he be happy, and how does he sort of reconcile who he is now with everything that's happened to him over the past few months since he lost his memory and was living as Rick Grayson, and, you know, his relationship with B and all of that sort of thing. And so you get that journey here. But you also get somebody showing up from Dick's past who has a lot to do with the situation that he's been in recently, where it looks like in the following issue in 76, he's going to have to confront that. And what will happen there may inform who Nightwing is going forward even more than Dick going on this emotional journey in this issue, talking to the Titans, talking to Bruce, talking to Barbara, and kind of explaining who he is and where he's at. It seems like he's you know, trying to reconcile all the different parts of his life together so he can move forward. And it feels like toward the end of the issue, he's made all the decisions himself, and now he's going to move forward in the way that he wants to. But with what happens on the final couple pages here, we see that it may not be that easy. It may be that those decisions are taken out of his hands by what's going to happen next. And so I'm curious to see, okay, what happens? Does Dick get to sort of have his cake and eat it too? Or is he going to suffer some tragedy, some loss, some more trauma? And how is that going to affect him? I mean, he's always been a pretty upbeat character, very grounded character. He's the favorite character of a lot of people I know, their favorite DC character. Can he maintain that optimism? Can he maintain who he is? I mean, the DC has really, and Dan Jurgens have really put him through the paces over the past couple of years with him losing his memory and such. So where it goes from here, you know, you would almost think, okay, issue 75, double page issue, Dick goes on this emotional journey, rediscover himself. We're going to know what the kind of the new status quo is for Nightwing going forward. But no, in fact, it's all set up for next issue to see. I mean, it's, and I don't mean to say that this issue wasn't good or it's just, you know, a lead in to the following issue, because there's a lot of good stuff here, especially the pages and the sequences with Dick dealing with the loss of Alfred. That's really powerful stuff. And so it definitely reminds us who Dick Grayson is, and we see the struggles that he's having. And obviously that's going to probably have an effect on the outcome of next issue, like whenever what's going to happens. And then how does Dick assimilate that into what happens next? So really interesting issue. The art for me was just okay. I mean, usually Travis Moore art for me is really great. I don't know if it's because him and Ronan Cliquet are working together, that it just, the line work wasn't the best. I thought the lines were kind of heavy. But it, I mean, it's not terrible. So there were some pages where I thought the art was really great. There was other pages where it just felt a little off to me. But I thought the color work was done really well. I think the panel layouts and the page layouts are done really well. I just felt the line work, especially in the faces, was a little lacking, a little inconsistent sometimes. And again, it just might be because we had two artists working on the issue, and that was probably because it's a double size issue, as I said. So, all right, up next we have Stillwater number 2. I mentioned this one earlier. It's from writer Chip Zdarsky. Co-creator Ramon K. Perez handles the art chores. We've got Mike Spicer on colors and Russ Wooten on letters. So I mentioned that the first issue of this I thought was just okay. If you're not familiar with the concept, it's about a town called Stillwater, where if you're within the borders of the town, you cannot be killed. And so the members of the town have to keep that secret, because obviously if that information got out to the wider world, town probably wouldn't even exist, right? All the people there would be hauled off and examined, and the town would be examined, and who knows if it would keep working, and yeah, bad things would happen. And so they're all sworn to secrecy, and they guard their secret and their town with much zeal. They seem to enjoy keeping the secret and basically killing anybody who discovers it. So I thought the first issue was okay, but I didn't really, it seemed like a lot of setup to where I didn't feel emotionally invested in the story. With issue 2, we start to kind of understand some of the relationships and the dynamics between the characters in the town and some of the characters that we were introduced to in the first issue that are from outside the town. So these connections and relationships and dynamics start to play out here. And the second issue I thought was leaps and bounds ahead of the first issue. Like I said, those character dynamics, the interactions between characters, and what we learn about the town, I thought all made for a really interesting narrative. When I finished the first one, I was kind of like, meh, that was okay. Interesting enough, I'll check out the second one because I'm kind of curious to see what happens. With the second issue, I'm highly anticipating the third. So we get some answers to some of the questions that were raised in the first issue, but that just opens up a whole nother avenue, a whole nother Pandora's box of questions and what happens next and what are the consequences. So I think the second issue, I really think maybe what they should have done was they should have gone double sized. They're larger books. They're like 30 pages, but they might have even been better off going for like a 60 pager or an 80 pager for the first and put the first two chapters together. Cause it's night and day. The second chapter is just, it gives you so much more of what you need to kind of understand. I mean, the first issue, it seems like it's the story of the characters from outside coming into the town. You're being introduced to them, and the town is sort of is a secondary character. In the second issue, it feels like the town itself, the concept of the town, the ideas behind it, the fact that you're immortal within the city limits, that is a character in and of itself. And it's the main character and the most important character. So I don't know, maybe they could have flipped them, done this one first, or given us that information first, or just tied it all together, or, you know, just do it the way you did it and, you know, hope that people are going to hang around for the second issue. Now I'm hooked. Now I'm very curious to see what happens next and kind of I don't want to say what the point of the story is, but what is Zdarsky going to examine? Cause now all the groundwork has been laid. And that's not to say all the questions have been answered or we know the lay of the land completely, but the groundwork has been laid to where going forward, he can still continue to explore the relationship between characters that is really interesting and done really well. But we're probably going to get an idea of what are the themes and the ideas that Zdarsky wants to examine, right? And he's probably going to do that. My guess would be he's going to do that by showing us the interaction between characters and the dynamics and the motivations behind the actions of the characters. That's how it'll be examined. So I'm really, really curious, because again, to mention Zdarsky on Daredevil again, that's what he's really great at. It's the emotional and the interpersonal. And so, like I said, there's things that he's done that I haven't cared for. You know, a Spider-Man life story comes to mind, but it was all emotion. It was all about the relationships. And it seems like that's where his strength lies. So it didn't work for me on Howard the Duck, though, for some reason. I don't know. Maybe it's the humor thing again. I guess I'm just a grouchy old man. I don't like funny books. So, all right, let me get to the last title that I'm going to talk about here. It's Spider-Woman number 5, but it's also issue 100. It's legacy issue 100. Apparently it's the 100th issue of Spider-Woman. So it's written by Carla Pacheco. Art is by Pierre Perez. Colors are by Frank DiArmada. Letters are by Travis Lanham. And then we've got a backup story called Legacy, also written by Carla, with art by Mateo de Ulis, I think is how you pronounce his name. It's I-U-L-I-S. Letters are also by Travis Lanham. So the new status quo of Spider-Woman, where she no longer has her quote-unquote healing factor, and so her powers are now killing her, and we found out she has some family that she didn't know about previously. And the main story ends up being just a giant climactic big fight where what Jessica Drew thought was actually her family and a certain situation turns out to be a little different than she thought it was. And at the end of the story, she doesn't have more questions than answers, but she definitely realizes things weren't what she was being told they were. And she kind of goes her separate way from her family. So at the end of issue 4, I thought, or during issue 4, I thought, oh, we're going to get this new status quo for Spider-Woman where she has this, you know, big supporting cast now, and it's, the book's going to go in a different direction. And instead it seems like maybe Carla Pacheco is flipping that on its head. And she's going to be sort of more alone than ever and reliant on herself, because she still has to find a way to heal herself. You know, she's still being poisoned by the serum that was injected in her that gave her the powers originally, right? Because her healing factor has been taken away. So if that's the case, then great. I kind of love a superhero against the world sort of story. Although I would have been fine with having that big supporting cast for a little while longer, just because I think it would have been something new and interesting and different. But instead, it seems like that supporting cast was sort of here and gone, but has left behind the potential for a lot of stories, and certainly has left behind the potential for them to come back in different ways and interact with Jessica in different ways. And who knows, maybe they will become part of the supporting cast, you know, further out in the future. And Jessica will get that sort of, Batman family, sort of feel, where she's got other members of her actual biological family that will join her supporting cast and be part of the title going forward. So, I thought it was a fun end to the first arc. I thought it was true to the character. I think the art by Pierre Perez is done really well. He has great page layouts. He definitely doesn't use, you know, just rectangular panel layouts. He's got really interesting panel layouts a lot of times. I mean, really interesting sometimes that grab the eye. So I thought all that was done really, really well. The color work is done well. The final page of the first story, as Jessica's flying off in the helicopter, is a great scene, what you see in the sky in the background is, again, just, it's inspired, done really, really well. So, and a lot of that probably has to do with the colors as well by Frank DiArmata. So got to give a shout out to him for that. The second story is kind of interesting. First of all, I'll say that the art is just gorgeous. Mateo de Ulis, it looks digitally painted. And I think this is his first Marvel work, maybe his first big two work. I did see him speaking on social media, or somebody was speaking on social media talking about it and showing some of these pages. I mean, it is spectacular. I can't imagine he's that fast though, because it's so detailed, it's so photorealistic and so beautiful. But it's basically Jessica sort of narrating where she is now after the first story and talking about the things that she's going to need to do going forward. So yeah, like I said, it seems like it's going to be a little bit of her on her own, or maybe just teaming up with one or two other heroes to try to get the answers that she's been looking for. And the other part of it, that's second story, is that it's interspersed with a bunch of covers. I don't know if they were like other ideas for covers for Spider-Woman 100, but it's just sort of weird. I mean, they're beautiful to look at, but you could have told more story instead of us having, let's see, it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 other covers. And the first one, it says Marvel Spotlight on the Spider-Woman. And I don't know, I guess it's just, I mean, the covers do sort of give us a kind of snapshots into different periods of Spider-Woman's life, I guess, or times. So I guess that's what they're trying to do with that. Give us sort of a retrospective of her through these different covers. And again, they're absolutely beautiful to look at, but they're not a narrative at all in terms of, you know, sequential storytelling. So it just felt a little weird. I mean, I guess if they were montages that gave us snapshots of certain eras of Spider-Woman's life, it would have felt like it flowed a little better. But as it is, you know, we just get a cover. Hey, this is Spider-Woman when she was, you know, just starting out. Or, you know, this is Spider-Woman when she was a member of the Avengers. Or this is Spider-Woman, you know, when she just had her baby. But we don't get any of the dialogue boxes, the exposition boxes that we get on the other pages where Jessica's kind of narrating where she's at in her life. So I guess I could have gone one way or the other. I mean, it's kind of an interesting way to do it, to have these covers in here. And like I said, they're certainly beautiful to look at, but I think I would have preferred to have the montages or just more panel work from Marco. Or Mateo, sorry, because his panel work, his visual storytelling in the other pages is just, like I said, spectacular. So really, really great. Did enjoy the Spider-Woman issue, the anniversary issue, and curious to see where Carla takes us next. So that does it for the books that I read that I wanted to talk about. Let me go ahead and give a rundown, because believe it or not, there are even more books that are coming out today than I mentioned. Starting with Aftershock, in addition to the Miles to Go number 2, which I highly recommend, we have Dead Day number 4. Over at Boom Studios, we have Dune House of Atreides number 1 of 12. So that's a year-long miniseries. Not sure how much it ties into the movie that has been pushed back, but if you're a fan of Dune, beware of that. There's also the latest issue of James Tynan's Something is Killing the Children with issue number 11. And that series continues to be really popular. Numbers continue to climb, which obviously is not typical of a comic series. Usually number one sells the most and you get attrition coming down. Over at DC, in addition to the books that I talked about, we have Aquaman number 64. We have Metal Men number 11 of 12, getting close to the end of that series from Dan Didio and Shane Davis. And we have Teen Titans number 46, which also has some little bit of Joker War. I know John Kent shows up there as well. So it's setting, kind of setting things up going forward with some of what's been going on in that corner of the DCU. Really light week from IDW, but I will mention Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles number 110. And if you haven't heard the Last Ronin, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles storyline, apparently not a lot of people pre-ordered. And then a ton of people did reorders on final order cutoff after the book had been sent to the printer. So apparently they're 130,000 copies short of the reorder. So it's already sold out and they're 130,000 copies short of pre-orders. So some people that some shops that ordered it are, it's going to be allocated. Not everybody's going to get all the copies they ordered. So it's already going to a second print, but you know, that doesn't necessarily matter. So everybody's going to be clamoring for that first print. So the first print's going to be red hot. And if you're a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle fan, I hope you're good friends with your shop and you're able to get a copy. Over at Image Comics, we have Black Magic number 15 from Greg Rucka and Nicholas Scott. We have Gideon Falls number 26, which is the penultimate issue of that series, about to come to a close. Scumbag number 1 is out today as well. So that's got some incredible art and story by Rick Remender. I read it. Didn't talk about it, obviously. Not sure if I liked it or not. It was interesting enough. The art is next level, but I'm just not sure if the story is interesting enough for me to hang around. I'll read one more issue and see where I land on that. Over at Marvel, we have Amazing Spider-Man number 50.LR. So that's the Last Right storyline that's being written by Nick Spencer along with Matthew Rosenberg that's going to run parallel for the next six issues or so of the Amazing Spider-Man story and get into the Kindred storyline and all of that. In the X-Men corner of Marvel, we have Excalibur number 13. We've got Marvel's X number 6 of 6. So that finishes off that miniseries. We also have Venom number 29 from Donny Cates and Ryan Stegman, and X-Men number 13. Lastly, I'll mention from Valiant, Ryan number 8 from Dan Abnett, with a regular cover by Walt Simonson, of all people. So that's pretty cool. All right, well, that's going to do it. And some of the other titles you may want to be on the lookout for today. I didn't really pick a book of the week, just because there were so many really good ones. I couldn't really choose. I think Catwoman is worthy. I think Iron Man number 2 is worthy. I think Miles to Go number 2 is worthy. Any of those could be book of the week. They're all absolutely outstanding. And a lot of the other titles that I read were pretty great too. So I hope you all enjoyed hearing me blab about comics as always. I want to thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.